911, what's your emergency?
Help, I think I might have a UTI. Self-diagnosed. I was, you know, trying to make this a real, authentic look at our lives today.
Oh my god. Well, Jane, how the hell are you?
Well, I'd be better if I didn't have a self-diagnosed UTI. But other than that, I'm great.
That'll put a damper on it. But we are celebrating because you just put out your 911 video a couple days ago.
That is true. I finally released my near 4-hour 911 video that I've been working on for weeks and weeks. So everybody go check that out. It's on YouTube. It's called Let's Talk About 911. And it's almost 4 hours long.
Hence why I haven't had the time to watch it yet. But from what I have seen, it's been really, really great. This is my ringing endorsement. I've seen the first 5 minutes. It's awesome.
Absolutely. Well, you can believe that the ensuing 225 minutes are just as good as the first five.
Jesus. And it's been getting big views so far.
Yeah, it's doing really well. It actually surpassed my, well, not surpassed, but like it's growing faster than my Steric video was, which was up to now my most popular or, you know, fastest growing video in a while. So that's good news. If you do better than Steric, that means you're very popular.
The Fujos yearn for Buddy.
It's true. It's true. Maybe we're entering a new era.
I think there genuinely is something to be said about that, though, because I think you pointed this out, is that like a lot of articles when they're talking about 911, is that the way that they get people to click on the article is to just have Buck and Eddie in like the thumbnail.
Yeah, they'll just use a picture of Buck and Eddie, even if the article is not remotely about them.
It'll be like, Angela Bassett talks about the new season to Jimmy Fallon.
picture of Buddy. Buck and Eddie. It's pretty shameless. Yeah. Even on like big publication, like I've seen like Deadline, Hollywood Reporter do this. No one is above it.
And if anything, I think that's like just concrete evidence that, I mean, Tim Minear, there's no possible way he can be ignoring this.
Oh, I think he's certainly not ignoring it. The question is just, will he act? Will he act?
A boy can dream.
Anyway, welcome back to the First Risk Podcast.
Yes, welcome back to the First Risk Podcast.
I'm Jane Mulcahy. I'm here with the wonderful, my fellow Irish-American, Ryan Kearns.
Yes, hello.
Today we are going to discuss 911 Season 1, Episode 2, Let Go.
Girl, we have had a time and a half trying to record this episode, haven't we?
It's true. We've rescheduled a lot, and now I'm sick with this punishment.
Yeah.
So it's been rough.
We also had to move it up a couple of hours because I forgot. I misread my schedule and realized that I have to be at work at 4:30.
You are God's strongest soldier.
I'm not the one with the UTI recording this. So
you are the one with a real job. So consider that.
It is true. I was on my computer. I was on my computer editing my my video that I'm working on right now, and I was just like, I hate having a real job. I hate having to go to work.
Why can't we just make YouTube videos about Ryan Murphy shows full time and be compensated
with money and Raid Shadow Legend subscriptions?
Oh, so true, so true.
All right, episode two. We open on a call. And this was the big call from the poster.
Yes.
This was at the state fair, I believe it was, or the county fair.
I think they say it's the state fair, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And these two guys are in line for a roller coaster. One of them is very, very anxious about it. The other is encouraging him and points to a couple of girls in line ahead of them and says, if we duck out of the line now, they're going to take pictures of us and post it online with the hashtag pussies. I don't want to be hashtag pussy.
I have to say, this was where, yeah, I did not realize you could say pussy on network TV, on broadcast TV. Very impressive.
In fairness, I think it's like the one per episode rule, like how they can only say fuck once in a PG-13
maybe
movie.
I didn't think that was how it worked on TV, but yeah, in episode one we got the word dick, and in episode two we get the word pussy.
Episode three we're gonna get like, I don't know, hole. Or taint. Whatever.
I have to say this opening call is like probably my worst nightmare of a 911 call, because you know what ensues is they get on this roller coaster, their bar keeping them in the roller coaster malfunctions, and one of the guys goes flying out of the roller coaster, and for some reason, instead of just like stopping the ride at a normal place or when it ends, they stop it right in midair on a loop while everybody's upside down, which leads to the other guy, like, you know, hanging on for dear life to the roller coaster. And yeah, this call. So I am terrified of roller coasters. I hate them. Are you really? Yeah, it's one of those things that I just like, it's not fun fear for me. It just like activates my fight or flight. I won't get on a roller coaster. I hate them. So that combined with the way that this call is all about this guy like being so socially anxious and being afraid of kind of the public shame, it just feels very personal to me. Like Buck is trying to rescue him when the 118 gets there, and the guy, like, all he can say is just like, everybody down there, they're laughing at me, they're gonna laugh at me, they're all filming this, they're gonna post it online. And I was just thinking, like, oh my god, like, this is how I'm going to go, you know? Probably, if I were in one of these situations, that would be me. Like, I don't even care about saving my own life. It's just like, oh my god, this is so embarrassing. And I just that was like haunting to me.
So his whole storyline really spoke to you in that way.
It did. Just like two of my worst fears, roller coasters and public shaming.
Did you see that video that was posted online by, what's his name? Super Eyepatch Wolf, Social Anxiety Horror.
I did not.
I feel like this is like very much that core. This is like, it's like combining the fear, like the primal terror that a lot of people have of roller coasters, like you said, with just like this, like, this sort of public spectacle of like shame that I feel like we're all kind of susceptible to, especially now, like, you know, walking around, there's like such a trend of like just people taking pictures of random people on the streets and pounding on them or something.
Can't ever be sure that you're not being recorded.
Yeah, it's like a weirdly modern take on, not like weirdly modern, it's like a interestingly modern take on like the sort of the Final Destination 3 scenario, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I was also going to bring up Final Destination 3, because how Final Destination core is this?
So core.
I was just watching that movie, so it also is very fresh in my mind. And yeah, they kind of hit a couple of the same scary points that are in the opening of that movie. But again, so effective. I think it was really smart to do like a roller coaster theme park disaster, because I think not only are those like really scary to people, but they're also just kind of sensational in that way. Like, you know, it's horrible, but it's very morbid. It brings out your morbid curiosity, I think. I've gone through like Wikipedia pages of all the Disney park disasters and stuff.
Yeah. You remember when like Thunder Mountain like derailed in like, it was like 2003 or something like that. Ugh, and it like killed a bunch of people. Yeah, it's like one of those, it's like a plane crash. It's not to be topical with this show, but but it's like a plane crash. It's like when one goes down, when one of them happens, like you hear about it, because it's such like a fucking like looming presence in your brain when you're doing it.
Even if it's super rare, both of these incidents are super rare, but when it does happen, it's so over the top horrible.
Yeah, because like, I mean, like, I'll be straight up, I love roller coasters. I love Couldn't roller coasters. So much. Like, I like, the reason I don't like Disneyland is because their roller coasters suck.
Maybe I would like their roller coasters.
It's like, well, it's like, they're really fun when you're like 8. But then like you go to Six Flags for the first time and you're like, oh wait, they could have loops in them? Like, whoa.
Well, that actually, that makes it sound like it's perfect for me, because I would absolutely only be able to go on little kid roller coasters.
Oh, like, I mean, like Space Mountain would be like your domain.
I've never been to any of the Disney parks.
But like, as someone who does love roller coasters and has that like sort of like thrill seeking drive, I guess, and has been to many a state fair in my day as a little country boy myself.
Of course.
I don't know. I loved this this hook. It's like this this opening call, because it's like, I feel like this is the call. Like, it was really smart for them to do the poster on this. You know what I mean? Because this is the one that's going to, like, really grab you, you know?
Yeah.
This is the one that's really going to grab you and be like, this is what the show is about. It's about the spectacle. It's about the sensationalism. But it's also about the sort of the human element. You know, Buck's up there and mm-hmm. it's his first time losing someone.
Yeah. So, of course, the big emotional thing that happens is he's trying to save this guy. The guy, I found this kind of weird. Buck's like, just put your arm through this harness. And the guy is too afraid to do that. I found it kind of weird that there would be no way to, like, put a harness on him without him actively reaching his arm through it. I feel like that's kind of a design flaw.
Yeah.
Because clearly, yeah, what if you're in a situation where someone's, like, unconscious and physically can't do that? Just seems odd.
Yeah.
But anyway, this guy can't bring himself to do that. And he's so embarrassed by everyone filming and just kind of terrified that he just lets go and lets himself fall to his death. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is very traumatic for Buck, which kind of introduces this entire episode will be very much a yeah. Buck episode, I would say. Yeah. What else is new?
Yeah. The breakout star of the show. Yeah. So, and it's like a real sort of, I guess, humbling moment. You see a real shift in his face there, and it's all, you know, mm-hmm. Oliver Sark's performance is fantastic, of course, you know, but when he's getting on the ladder, you know, I mean, Bobby rolls in and he's like, we came in at the wrong angle, we need you to go up there while we reposition. And he's like, yes, this hero daredevil saving people stuff is like why I joined up in the first place.
Yeah, very silly thing of him to say.
And then this guy fucking dies, like, right in front of him. And
yeah,
he's like, wait, what's happening on this job?
Right. Like, very clearly introduces he still thinks it's all about the fun and being a brave hero. And then it's like, actually, this job kind of sucks.
Yeah.
So we cut right to 118 family dinner of sorts.
Yes.
Buck is despondent, as he often is on this show. And Hen brings Athena in. This is kind of a fun moment where we get our first mm-hmm. clue that Hen and Athena mm-hmm. are buddies. Hen comes yeah. in, she's like, Athena's been having a hard time at home, so she's mm-hmm. going to join us today. And the rest of the team are kind of trying to console Buck.
But you see, like, a sort of a camaraderie in the way that the rest of the team greets Athena, you know.
Yes.
Chimney and Bobby give her, like, side hugs and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, so these people have worked together for years.
Right, that's what it seems like, for sure. Yeah. You know, she begrudgingly accepts Buck into her circle.
I do like that. I do like that they do still have that, I guess, that thorniness a little bit about it. Because, mm-hmm. like, obviously there's that classic cops versus firefighters rivalry that right. this show likes to play with from time to time. But also, I feel like if she just waltzed in and everyone was, like, you know, like, happy and supportive right off the bat, and that would be a little, I'm not trying to slur this in any way, but tumblery.
Tumblery. Oh god, I get what you mean. Yeah, of course. Yeah. We're setting up all of our dynamics and they're not all perfect and rosy yet, and that's great. Yeah. I wanted to mm-hmm. say about this scene, I feel like it's one example of how much Chimney has changed over the course of the show, because he has that line where he's like, you're thinking about these calls as relationships and really they're like yeah. one night stands. And I just got the mm-hmm. impression that, like, I feel like that's not something Chimney would say even just a little bit later on in the show. You know, he comes off as a little more, like, cynical and non-committal in the first season.
Yeah, yeah, he does. He does. I noticed that too. And it's like, it was like what we talked about last week, where they hadn't quite nailed down Chimney's character yet, and, like, no. what his relationship to women was, and what mm-hmm. his sort of relationship to his sex life was, and his romantic life was, and all that, and they were still trying to figure it out.
But when they do, boy do they.
Yes they do. And we get a diva to come and you know, iron out his kinks, so to speak. I'm literally just like fucking, like, sitting here biting my nails waiting for Jennifer Love Hewitt to show up, because I love her so much.
So true. I know, can't wait till season two. But of course, then the scene ends with our classic 911 scenario of dinner being interrupted by a 911 call.
Mm-hmm.
So the bell starts ringing. They all have to stop eating. We cut to Abby and Carla. We meet Carla for the first time.
Yes, this is Carla's introduction. She, like, works with an agency or something like that.
Well, Abby's mom has locked herself in the bathroom because she's mm-hmm. has Alzheimer's and has kind of forgotten how to get out. And yep. just that moment, Carla shows up. Abby is so shocked that finally one of these people from one of these agencies is on time. Carla, you know, works her magic, gets the mom out easily. And that's Carla.
That's Carla.
She's great at her job.
Yeah. She just kind of comes in and just takes charge. And it's like, oh my God, where have you been?
Right, right.
You know what I mean? So how do you feel about Carla? Because I really like Carla as a character.
Yeah, I mean, I think she's all good. I sometimes wish we could get a little more depth from that character. Because I have to say, especially in this episode, I'm not trying to be the friend that's too woke or whatever. But, you know, this episode was written by Ryan Murphy, Tim Minear, and Brad Falchuk, three older white men. And I couldn't help but notice that, like, almost all of Carla's lines kind of feel like these very stereotypical, like, sassy black older woman stereotype kind of line. Fair. She has this really weird line at one point where she says to Abby, she's like, "You are a hot pumpkin spice latte."
Right.
And I just remember thinking, like, knowing that this was written by three white guys, I feel like that is a rather embarrassing line to give the actress. And I feel like she often shows up as, like, you know, she's the nurturing, kind, good at everything, kind of sassy woman caregiver. And it feels like we don't really get a lot of, like, her inner world, like who she is. Yeah. And I'm not saying, like, you can't have every minor character be, like, super involved, but it'd be nice if there was maybe a sign here and there that she wasn't just, like, this kind of one-dimensional, like, stock character in that way.
Yeah. I mean, she was such a big part of the show for a while, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And she had this presence that, like, was very important, especially to Abby's character and later to Eddie's character, of course, as we'll get into later on. Mm-hmm. But I definitely agree with that. And, you know, it's like, it's a stereotype in itself, this sort of stock black caretaker character with a very loaded history. Knowing, especially Ryan Murphy and Brad Falchuk's history with writing black women as well, it's like, I think it's definitely fair to side-eye it a little bit.
Yeah, I'm not Gen Z trying to cancel Ryan Murphy per se, although I also think he's, like, a kind of chaotic, like, I have no skin in the defending Ryan Murphy game whatsoever. He's just, like, a neutral evil to me, kind of. But yeah, I think it's worth noting, at least. I'm not saying it ruins the show or the character, but
Gen Z is trying to what? Cancel Carla Price.
Not cancel her, cancel the annoying people who write her.
But I will say, her actress sells the fuck out of it, you know?
And the actress is great. That's Coco Brown, I think.
She's fun and she's sweet and she has a great energy about her. And so, like, if anything, like, it just, like, the vibe shift that she sort of, like, brings to the sort of the Abby sort of Abby mom dynamic is that on its own is, like, such a thing of to, I guess, appreciate.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Very good energy from Carla, for sure.
And I will say this, the caretaker drama with Abby and her mom is, like, consistently a high point of the show for me so far.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and, like, because it is the portrayal of dementia is pretty restrained compared to other media that depicts it.
Right. I think it does get worse as the season goes on, but yeah, it never feels like particularly sensational. I mean, worse as in her Alzheimer's gets worse, not like the depiction gets worse. Sorry, that's confusing.
Yeah, no, but I know what you mean. She definitely deteriorates as it goes on, but, like, in these starting episodes, it's not like, you know, a switch flips in her brain and suddenly she's getting violent and, you know, screaming about who is she and where is she and all that stuff. That
it's interesting, like,
even tired.
Even when she gets unlocked from the bathroom, she's kind of, like, apologizing. Like, she still kind of is lucid. She just is, like, not, her brain isn't functioning about everything anymore.
Definitely. Definitely.
We move on to, we see a little bit of Athena and Michael's life at home. And her daughter, May, is saying she's sick and doesn't want to go to school. So that's just kind of a small moment that will be important later.
A little seedling. A little seedling. That it's like it's all they give us for what will become a big reveal, and it's kind of all we need, you know.
Mm-hmm. Definitely,
all we need.
We cut to 911 call. Someone is being attacked by dogs. I like this scene a lot.
The fucking no scrubs needle drop, iconic.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So the guy calls 911. He's being attacked by dogs. Athena, like, makes a bunch of cars move out of the way, pulls up to a drive-through window, asks for 4 cheeseburgers, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And what is the other thing she gets? A root beer or something?
Some fries in a separate bag and a medium root beer.
Nice. Great order.
Iconic.
Little bit of poor cop behavior, I would say, to kick everybody out of the drive-through line. Anyway,
Definitely. She
goes to the house, and Hen and Chimney also show up as paramedics. Guy is, like, on top of a table in the kitchen being attacked by two Dobermans, I think.
Yeah, they're Dobermans, yeah.
Turns out the cheeseburgers were to throw to distract the dogs and, like, get them into a closet so that they could wait for animal control.
The dude's fucking spraying them with a hose, by the way.
Yeah, he's spraying them with, like, a spray bottle, which, yeah. Understandably, either Hen or Athena is like, well, you should probably stop doing that.
Yeah.
Just gonna make
all
them
you're
angry.
Doing is, like, hydrating them, dude. Like, oh, they're fucking, like...
making them stronger.
It's just water, you know what I mean? Like...
Well, what I always think is funny about this scene is that they chose to get cheeseburgers to distract the dogs instead of trying maybe, like, dog treats first. I don't know, maybe it's more convenient to go through a drive-thru and get burgers than go somewhere and get dog treats. I just remember thinking, like, man, you waste 4 burgers on those dogs.
Yeah.
But I guess it was life or death.
Do you think she had to pay for those?
Honestly, probably not. Because, you know, I used to work at an ice cream shop in high school. And the owner of the ice cream shop would make us give free ice cream to cops. And even at the time, I was very morally
Christ.
Conflicted about that.
Yeah.
But it was our store policy. So I think cops mm-hmm. do get a lot of free stuff wherever they go.
That's interesting. Because I worked in Dairy Queen. And it's not that we didn't have a policy for that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just that cops never came through our Dairy Queen.
Yeah, it was a rare occurrence at my place, but yeah.
I like the cheeseburger thing, not because it makes more sense, but because, I don't know, it kind of highlights a sort of a unique strength of this show, which is that with the calls and everything, the calls are basically, like, I think they're basically all about, like, finding creative solutions to, like, whatever problems they can throw these
right.
people into. You know what I mean?
And also, like, subverting expectations, I guess. You see her going through the drive-thru and you're not sure what the plan is yet.
And that's what's fun. It's fun.
It's fun. You're right. I shouldn't be. I'm doing, like, Cinema Sins level, like, why is it cheeseburgers? That's not fair.
No. You're not. I didn't mean to imply that. I just meant, like, maybe part of it was just that, like, low-key, like, a burger sounds good right now, too, so.
So you're, like, empathizing with the Dobermans.
Exactly.
Of course.
Exactly.
I mean, who wouldn't in this scene, especially what we find out later? So, speaking of she gets the dogs taken care of, and the guy kind of flirts with Athena while thanking her. We see Hen and Athena kind of having a little chat, again, showing mm-hmm. their friendship. And, mm-hmm. you know, Hen's saying, you know, did you see what that guy was doing? Maybe you should think about dating again. But Athena's still feeling very much like a married woman. She's not really sorted this situation with Michael yet. So she's not really open to that. Then the owner of the house comes home and she's like, you're the owner of this house? He's like, where are my dogs? She
and
says,
like, well...
you'll be pleased to know they've been fed and they're safe. But the dogs at this point have been taken away by animal control, which I have to say, I was looking at the IMDb trivia and goofs for this episode before we started this call, because I wanted to see if there was, like, anything interesting I could share. And there wasn't really, but there was. Apparently, Hen has this line where she says, like, we're going to have animal control test the dogs for rabies. And at least according to the IMDb goofs, there is actually not a test for rabies that you can do in live animals. Like, you can only test for it after they're dead. You take, like, a sample of their brain. So that would not
have they're
going to
fucking kill the dogs.
Well, yeah, possibly. I hope that guy got in contact with animal control before it was too late.
Jesus Christ. Is that true?
I believe the thing about the rabies test is true, but I think the show just didn't know that. I think they intended.
Oh, well, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember that because I literally just watched this episode. And so, like, I just thought when I heard that, I'm like, I thought when I heard that, I was like, oh, saliva test. Oh, they'll find the bacteria, the saliva or whatever. You know what I mean?
I mean, it is weird when you think about it that we wouldn't have a test for rabies yet. You'd think that would be a priority. Maybe it's difficult. You know, I am really afraid of rabies. I'm afraid of roller coasters and I'm afraid of rabies.
Not the two biggest fears in one episode.
Yeah, rabies is like one of the scariest. It's just like the scariest disease. Mm-hmm. You get it. You might not even know you get it. You know, if you get bit by mm-hmm. something while you're sleeping or whatever. And then unless you get the shots really early on, there's just like nothing you can do. And your brain will just like melt and you'll die.
Did you ever see that episode of Scrubs where that woman died and they couldn't find the cause of death, but she was an organ donor and they needed a bunch of organs for a bunch of patients and they transferred. Sorry, this is gonna be, no, I'm not
no,
gonna, I'm not, because
tell it to
you
me.
Know where this, okay, so And so they transfer a bunch of her organs to a bunch of these different patients, and it's fantastic. And then all the patients start deteriorating in the exact same way, and they find out, oh, she had a rabies.
Oh my God. This is why we need the live rabies test. Oh my God. Why are scientists not getting on this?
Yeah. And like, but like the doctor who ordered like the transplants, like he has like this great like breakdown scene. It's actually like a really interesting drama scene. That song from The Fray they use in Grey's Anatomy plays in that scene.
How to Save a Life?
Yep.
Yeah, they use that in every doctor show. You have to, like, take a shot every time they use that in a doctor show. I think they do it in-house at least once, too.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. All right, so then from that call, we get more Abby Carla moments.
Well, I want to say the end of that call is, you know, the first guy who was being attacked by the dogs has left, and Athena has this revelation, and she's like, that guy was a burglar, and I let him get away, is what she said. And I was just thinking, I was thinking about this last night of, like, if I had had my house robbed, like, I feel like that's not something you say out loud to the owner of the house. It's kind of, like, imagine if he decides to sue or something. It's not going to be a good look that you stood in front of him and said, your house was just robbed, and I let him get away.
I don't know. Angela's, like, the queen of, like, those, like, punchy moments. So, like, I didn't even register that, what you just said.
I think I just, hadn't even really registered it while watching, but it came to me later. Like, maybe she should have kept that to herself.
Right. So maybe don't admit fault on the scene. It's like getting into a car accident.
Exactly, exactly. Although, maybe as a cop, she knows there won't be any true consequences for any of her actions.
That's true.
Like you said, we cut to more Carla and Abby. Carla has kind of gotten her mom down for a nap, and so Abby is like, thank God, can kind of finally relax.
Yeah, having a glass of wine.
Yeah, they share a glass of white wine. White wine moment. This show is so full of white wine.
Carla name drops. Abby's ex, who's totally not currently in a relationship with a man, Tommy.
Okay, we have to stop with the Tommy references. This is premature.
I know. No, it's just, it's a guy named Tommy, her ex. And Abby is talking about how her mom remembers when they were together, and so it sort of defaults to that, which makes her relive the worst breakup of her life.
Mm-hmm. Which, funnily enough, they then see on the news, on TV, Buck is being interviewed by a news reporter. Again, he's been getting lots of press since this roller coaster rescue. And we have a couple different scenes where we see, like, reporters asking him, like, what was this heroic rescue like? And then Buck is like looking completely dead inside. He's like, I don't know. The guy just let go. I asked him to hold on, and he let go. And then, you know, the reporter's like, all right, back to you, whatever.
It's like a fantastic moment for Buck, because it's like, you know, if it had happened like a week before this, you know, then he would have been peacocking so hard. You know what I mean? But because he's had this sort of like sort of traumatic sort of humbling experience, now he's fucking it's like just like really sort of reserved, and like you see this shift in his character, and it's really interesting. It's like the start of his growth as a person.
I wanted to say, on the news, they say this line. They say, people are calling Evan Buckley the County Fair Spider-Man.
Is that where line. It comes from? Is that where the Spider-Buck thing comes from?
I was not aware of this being a thing. What?
I've only heard whispers of this in the fandom. But apparently, like there's this like big like headcanon, or like this sort of like just this fun sort of fan interpretation of Buck as like an incarnation of Marvel's Spider-Man.
That's kind of silly. I mean, is it just because he climbs a lot of things?
I think so. Plus, he's like white and has that sort of same physical appeal of Peter Parker. I'm gonna look up Spider Buck right now. I'm gonna look up Spider Buck right now on Google Images.
Great.
Oh, yep. 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 Yeah, lots of fan art. So people just
that
like to do Spider Buck and his 118 stuff.
That kind of makes me cringe, to be honest with you.
Okay, it comes from this one person on Twitter who did a Spider Buck and Daredevil Eddie AU. So it all comes back to Buddy, because of course it does.
Of course. This is getting a little too esoteric for me.
This is getting esoteric. This is getting off track. Let's reel it back in. What Spider-Man was he? The County Fair Spider-Man or something?
People are calling Evan Buckley the County Fair Spider-Man.
Right.
Which, hilariously, this scene also features a line from Carla where she compares Buck to the Road Warrior. She says he's like a Road Warrior looking guy, which I assume is a reference. Yeah, I assume that's a reference to Mad Max 2, the Road Warrior. Which I can't say I've seen Mel that Gibson. Movie. Yes, I haven't seen that movie. I will say I looked up pictures of Mel Gibson in that movie. I don't think he resembles Buck at all. Like, not even just in a general. So I don't. No. I feel like that can only be an effect of, like, either Ryan Murphy or Tim Minear or Brad Falchuk were, like, big Mad Max fans and decided to drop this weird old man reference into the episode.
Oh, you know, it was probably Brad Falchuk, because every fucking podcast I've listened to where they mention Brad Falchuk, especially the Glee kids, they all talk about the fact that he's the straightest person to ever live in the history of the world.
So that would kind of explain it.
Yeah, that's where they got all the classic rock on Glee, is just from Brad Falchuk.
That's so funny.
And so it was probably just like him inserting this, like, oh yeah, he looks like Mel Gibson in Mad Max 2, the third best Mad Max movie.
Or maybe that was him trying to think of, like, who's a hot guy? Like, who would be a guy that women like?
Right. Who's this it's like straight men all like chomping at the bits for Ryan Reynolds of all people.
Right. And it's like, what do you see in that guy?
Right. And it's like, oh no. So you really aren't attracted to men.
It's something very funny to me about this hypothetical of, yeah, you know how women are always talking about how much they love Mel Gibson in Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior? Buck's like that.
Well, maybe this is a peek at Carla's inner world. Maybe she's just a huge Mad Max fan.
Oh my god, that's my new headcanon. That is so funny. Carla, caretaker extraordinaire and huge Mad Max stan.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And she'd be like a snob about, like, she'd be like, yeah, Mad Max Fury Road was good, but the old ones are way better than the new ones.
She's very anti-Tom Hardy in the role.
Right, right. She's like, mm-hmm. He's no Mel Gibson.
Mm-hmm. She listens to Thunderdome on repeat on her fucking, the Tina Turner song. We don't need another hero. Okay. So then Carla calls Abby a cougar. Because Buck's a dog, true. And all firefighters are dogs, and Abby's a cougar.
An interesting thing to say.
Right. And convinces Abby to go and call Buck and get him on the phone.
Which she does.
And she does. While he's at work in the valley or wherever, putting out a forest fire.
This was a note I had, because he's not even like, I'm pretty sure there was another time she calls him when he's on a call, but he's like just kind of finishing a call, walking back to the fire engine, and I could see that. But in this case, he's like actively putting out a fire. Any firefighter listeners out there, do you think that a firefighter would actually hear his phone buzzing, take off his like mask, his protective equipment, and answer a phone call while actively putting out a forest fire? That felt maybe a little, I'm not sure if that would really happen, but who knows?
Yeah. To specify just how actively, I mean, the, like, hose in his hand, you know,
yes,
what I mean?
Hose on.
Yeah. Like,
another, hose, oh my on. God, Ryan, another phallic symbol.
Another phallic symbol.
While Abby's another calling phallic him. Symbol.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's representing their psychosexual dynamics of their relationship.
Mm-hmm. If it proves one thing, it proves this. Buck has hoes.
Oh, man.
He calls, he answers the phone, and it's Abby, and they flirt a little bit, and he's like, how did you get this number? She's like, oh, you know, the Yellow Pages, like, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the entire fandom seems to think that that's problematic, but it's fine. It's whatever.
She says it was like in the file for the call that they had together, which I don't think is that bad. And yeah, Buck clearly doesn't have any problem with it. So like, who cares?
And she obviously has access to the file for a call that she took and played a very active role in, right?
It doesn't sound like she like went really out of her way to it. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter to me what she did to find his number, because yeah, Buck doesn't express any discomfort with her having his
at
number
all.
So whatever
at all. Yeah,
then we go to the funeral for Devin, the man who died on the roller coaster.
Before we do, actually, I kind of want to talk about just like one little thing on this phone call, which is interesting because it kind of speaks to the theme of this episode, but also the show almost, and also possibly why this relationship was kind of a bad idea from the start. This might be a hot take, is that I'm not here to tell anyone how to like live their lives and relationships and whatnot. But I will say that generally speaking, from what I've observed in, you know, my own life and just like from around, you know, the world and whatnot, I've seen that relationships that have a foundation on like sort of this trauma bonding experience tend to, they have a perhaps a greater capacity to devolve into some sort of unhealthy dynamics going down the line.
You know what I mean by that? You could say them having met in this really intense way and largely, a lot of their relationship at first is like Buck confiding his feelings in her that, maybe that was not the best foundation for like a long lasting relationship.
Yeah, because they're connecting here, you know, and it's like it's very sweet, and like you can totally see that they sort of need someone to talk to about all this stuff. I don't know, just like from the way that they talk about sort of their experiences with like death on the job and all that stuff, it's like, I don't know, man, I'm not them, you know what I mean? I'm not them. I can't tell them how to live their lives. I'm just saying, like, for me, if I was like starting a relationship with like a guy and like the first thing that we really bonded over on the first date was like our experiences with death, I don't know that I'd want to see him again.
Well, that's why Buck didn't stay with his death doula girlfriend in season 6.
True. That's true. Oh my God, growth.
Growth, yeah. Yeah. But I mean, you know, Buck and Abby ultimately kind of stepping stones for each other, which ends up making sense, I think.
Yeah. They both need something that the other has sort of within them. And so they find that within each other. And yeah, it's sweet. It's sweet. It's good.
He's a dog and she's a cougar by Carla's standards.
Is it possible for a canine boy and a feline girl to find love? Right. Devin's funeral. Yes, Devin's funeral.
Yeah, so we cut to Devin's funeral, the man who died on the roller coaster, and his sister is speaking and kind of approaches Buck afterwards. And Buck, I think, is seeking out like some answers kind of for why this happened, trying to reconcile it emotionally. And he kind of accidentally offends this woman by saying, you know, she asks him like what really happened up there. And he says, I don't know, it's like he just gave up. Which it's crazy. Like how he was feeling, but definitely not the right thing to say to the dead man's sister.
And she understandably gets upset about it and sort of pins a lot of her grief and frustration and sort of anger on him, and in a very pointed way.
She says something like it was your fault. You're the reason he died, which is, you know, definitely not like what you Buck failed needed to him. Hear.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. But it's also like, Buck, you gotta think about your words a little bit before saying them. Oh, I wanted to say about this funeral scene, and this is like a thing in movies and TV that always makes me laugh. The photo of Devin on top of his casket is very clearly the actor's acting headshot. I love in movies when there's supposed to be like a family photo or some, like a memorial photo. And it's just obviously it's like their smiling face in very well lit with like a blank background. Yeah. It's like, oh, that's like, your acting headshot.
Who's this guy that like he's depressed and, you know, formerly suicidal and, you know, has been in a hole for the last 2 months and, you know, who's this guy who's going to go out and pay a photographer to get professional headshots?
You know, he was struggling, but he still had time to go get some headshots taken. And that's really admirable.
It is admirable. And honestly, it's like aspirational, even one might say.
So then we go to, the women. We cut to a couple women working in an office. And there's kind of a creepy window washer who like is always leering at them from outside. And suddenly his cord breaks and he's like dangling off the roof of this building.
This is very iCarly core. Shout out to that one episode.
True. I forgot. Wait, what happens in that episode?
Carly and Sam are in a fight, and through some Nickelodeon shenanigans, they get out on a window washing unit. Presumably for the purposes of their show, but who knows, it could be anything. Then one of the cords on the window washing unit snaps and Carly like dangles off of it, and they have to like pull them up. And then they crawl into the window and they just like start crying and hugging each other. And it's like,
yeah, they reconcile their fight by being in this near death experience. That's so funny. Yeah. So similar thing happens, except presumably this guy did not resolve his sexual harassment of these women after he had his near death experience. We don't get to see the aftermath, but this is an opportunity for Buck to have an opportunity to like do another kind of rescuing a person in a similarly precarious situation to the beginning of the episode, and he actually kind of chickens out. And it's actually kind of confusing the way they like cut it in the episode. Did you think this? That he says, like, I'm gonna go to the top of the building, and then we just kind of cut to him in the locker room, and he and Bobby have like an emotional talk, and Buck's like, I know I let you down. And so I didn't really get at first. I had to rewind because I was like, what did he do that let him down? Is it just like it happens off screen?
I think it happens off screen. I think the implication was this was another call that went wrong for similar reasons. Mm-hmm. Whether it was Buck hesitating, because we kind of see him hesitate in the doorway, or maybe it's just another person lost.
Maybe it's just supposed to be him hesitating was how he let him down. But I don't know. I was a little confused. I wish they had communicated that a little better.
But I do think the pervy guy died because, I mean... For God's sakes, he was dangling by his foot and there was no indication that he survived, and it was a very somber mode, and so I think that might have been Buck losing a second person on the job.
I didn't assume that, honestly. I thought maybe just him hesitating was the bad part and then they saved him anyway. But this is the consequence of not showing it on screen, is we have no idea.
We have to save money. We can't do all of these stunts.
I guess. So yeah, then Buck and Bobby have a little heart-to-heart. Buck reveals that he almost joined the Navy SEALs instead of becoming a firefighter.
Yeah.
But he says they just wanted robots and machines, and I was too emotional and baby girl for the job, so I came here instead. Which, thank God, because we don't need multiple characters on this show being involved with the military, to be quite honest.
No, we don't. So after this talk with Bobby, because Bobby probably recognizes a lot of himself in Buck in this moment as well, I would say. I mean, he sort of kind of always does, but I think in this moment of like not being able to turn himself off and feeling sort of adrift in that sense, you know, not really having a place to place his feelings.
He reveals that he also remembers exactly like the first person he lost on the job.
Yeah, like down to like specific details about like that she had painted smiley faces on the toes of her shoes.
Right. So it's very, it felt very TV show to me that moment. I was like, oh yeah, he's going to remember every detail. Yeah. he tells Buck to go to therapy, basically, which leads to a crazy scene.
Crazy scene.
We are intercutting between Buck seeing a therapist and Athena and Michael seeing a couples therapist. So Athena and Michael are having this kind of interesting conflict where it's revealed basically through this conversation that Athena does not want to get a divorce. She is content with having like this non-romantic, non-sexual marriage and having that just last. Michael is immediately like, he's like, here's the thing. I've met someone. Which I thought was like a little out of pocket for him to just like immediately spring that on her. I could totally understand. I think Athena's being very unrealistic when she says, like, no, like, let's just stay married. I'm okay with being celibate for the rest of my life. I would have totally understood. But I feel like he maybe should have just said, like, that doesn't sound realistic. We both deserve to be happy. Saying, I've met someone already when we haven't even agreed to get a divorce is kind of crazy.
It's absolutely crazy. And, like, I mean, I guess if there is a place to do it, it is kind of like getting shot in a hospital, saying that during couples counseling. But, I mean, you're still getting shot, right? Like, and so, I don't know. It's like, on the one hand, it was, like, a part of me does want to sympathize with Michael in that, like, I mean, if someone asked me to, I guess, live a celibate life, I would immediately have, like, kind of an oppositional
Yeah, no, he totally has a right to object to that. I just feel like maybe he should have kept the I met someone thing on the down low for a little longer.
Definitely. Definitely, definitely. I mean, there is such a thing as tact, right?
right. Yeah, I think it just would have been, you could have just said, I don't think that's realistic, and both of us maybe deserve to move on.
Especially because it's clear that Michael really still like cares about Athena and still really loves Athena. Right. And so it's like,
supposedly.
supposedly. And so it's like, why? I mean, I don't know, you might want to care about her a little bit more.
It's a lot.
Because she's going through a really hard time.
What we're intercutting with that is Buck in therapy with this, you know, attractive young woman therapist. And she immediately, like, as soon as he starts talking about his problems, she kind of, like, walks over and, like, sits down next to him and holds his hand, which I already was like, okay, interesting. Yep. And then suddenly, oh, my God, bombshell. Buck says, wait a minute, did you friend me on Facebook? Therapist is like, that was before I had you as my patient.
That was before.
But, you know, Buck's been on the news all week because of this roller coaster thing. So presumably she found him and friended him on Facebook and still agreed to this therapy appointment. And then they sleep together in the therapist's office. Yeah. So Buck is still Buck 1.0.
Yeah.
This is very, very alarming on the therapist's part, I would say.
Oh, 100%.
She does at least seem self-aware about it right after it happens, but it's like, girl, should have had the foresight to not do this, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, the post-nut clarity, I get it. Like, I mean, girl, like, you're gonna, you know, it stops and you're like, oh my God, I regret it already. It's like, wow, imagine if you didn't do it. Like, I mean, because it's the kind of thing that can, like, get your license revoked. And it's also, like, well, yeah. I mean, okay, so... Should we just rip the Band-Aid off of this discussion?
How so?
Was Buck assaulted in this scene?
Ooh, right. I think this was very unethical on the part of the therapist. I think this was probably... I mean, it's coercive in a way because he's in a vulnerable place by being in therapy. Yeah. I don't know if it's equivalent to, like, sexual assault. And... Mm-hmm. I think it's relevant to say that the show never frames it that way. Buck never seems to feel that way. And I know it can be, I just think sometimes you see this in fandoms where they'll be like judging things, not based on what the text tells you about it, but based on their own interpretation of those events, which is fair. But also I think, you know, it's worth acknowledging the way the text frames it.
Yeah, definitely.
I think it's sort of, if anyone, you can condemn maybe the writers for not giving that the full weight it deserved. But in the show, it does not seem like Buck feels like a victim. Yes, I would say in real life, this would be a very sinister situation, potentially.
And it's a real thing that happens. You know, I was actually looking at statistics and there was like an alarmingly high percentage of reported cases of situations like this happening. Jeez. And so, like, I'm not the kind of person who's just going to go out of my way to, you know, make Buck a victim if the show never... makes him one, or if he doesn't, you know, ever give voice to feeling like one or anything like that. And, like, so I totally agree with you on that. Like, there is, like, the imbalance of power and everything, which is ethically reprehensible, obviously.
I feel like if you were ever going to make Buck a victim, this is probably the one, like, justifiable place. Yeah. Because, yeah, that is objectively pretty bad.
Yeah. It's, like, it's the most frequently cited, I would say, one of the most frequently cited things of his, like, character backstory. But I don't know. I feel like I do see this every now and again sort of thrown around as an excuse to do fandom shipping war bullshit somehow.
Right. Anytime anything is motivated by fandom shipping war bullshit, I feel like you can assume that it's not actually terribly concerned with, like, the welfare of victims or actually advocating for any moral justice.
Yeah.
So I agree that this is very bad and would be very bad in real life. I also think if it's just like another bullet point on someone's list of reasons why X ship is good or X ship is bad or X woman deserves to die or whatever, it's probably not that valid.
I agree with that.
And it's just not terribly relevant to who Buck is today, because, again, the show has never made that a thing for him. But, could have been worth examining more from the writers at the time. But I guess, I mean, it's Ryan Murphy. Come on. he's not known for his taste.
No, he's not. That's not what we love him for. Like, with the I guess the Buck thing, my only, I guess, 2 cents that I'll throw in is that it's, I guess, if people want to talk about, you know, having a victim-centric or a survivor-centric attitude when it comes to talking about these sorts of things, then it's worth centering what the survivor says about it. And the only thing Buck said about this encounter with her, literally the only thing in the scene, is you're a therapist, I feel better.
What a crazy line.
Crazy line. You know what I mean?
Well, there is a part towards the end of the episode where he and Abby are talking on the phone, and he's saying, like, I don't think we should meet up because I think we would end up having sex because every girl I talk to, I end up having sex with. And he has some line about, like, I guess, like, I'm just like a magnet or something. And that made me feel kind of bad because I was like, Buck, like, it wasn't your fault that that happened to you.
No.
It's not that you just have some inherent thing that women can't resist. It's like that woman should have not done that. So that is one moment where I felt bad for him in that way. But
In fairness, he does have one thing that women can't resist. And men, too, which is being played by Oliver Stark.
True. We can't dispute that.
Listen, if Evan Buckley was a real person, I would friend him so hard on Facebook.
But you also hopefully would not be his therapist.
Whether I was... No, I'm just kidding. No. Log onto Facebook.com so hard, and I would friend request the fuck out of that man.
You would friend request him so hard, Mark Zuckerberg would feel it in Silicon Valley.
Yes. Jesse Eisenberg himself would feel it.
Jesse Eisenberg would wake up in a cold sweat one night.
He'd be like, no way.
Okay, we cut from the therapy to Athena catching the burglar. She does a very, like, stealthy honeypot kind of thing where she calls him on the phone and she kind of pretends to be a past female acquaintance of his. She's like, you told me to call you if I ever needed a real man. Well, here I am. And she kind of sneaks up on him in that way. I think she kind of similarly to in the first episode with the burglary, I feel like she kind of reveals herself too quickly, which results in a police chase that maybe wasn't necessary. But anyway, she does all that. She chases him. I feel like this is one of the first uses of her personally motivated excessive force.
She's
like really aggressively arresting this guy, like slamming him on the car, whatever, clearly out of her own personal thing that she's going through, as opposed to the actual utility of the arrest.
To the point where another cop has to like step in and be like, Athena, you're doing a lot.
You can't do that. Yeah. So, you know, classic Athena thing to do.
Love that this guy already like had a girl he was waiting on. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No. Yeah. Because he doesn't recognize who she's talking about because she's made something up. But I guess he's just such a player that he just assumes that makes sense. I like that line where she says, like, we could meet up for a little afternoon delight. And he's like, afternoon delight? Girl, you got to work on your euphemisms. That's true. That was good.
She went to the celibacy club.
Apparently, yeah.
And so I guess like you said, that's Athena's first on-screen instance of excessive force. And not her last.
Not her last. So then we cut to our kind of last call of the episode, I think.
The most LA relationship ever seen on TV.
Yeah, there's a man threatening to jump off of his apartment balcony because he thinks his girlfriend that apparently hates him and he apparently hates back is cheating on him. It's kind of, if such a thing exists, it's kind of a lighthearted suicide call.
It really is. No, it is.
You know, you get the impression that it's not very serious, that maybe he doesn't even really intend to jump, that they're framing this as very humorous, like the dispute between these two. Bobby says when the 118 gets there, he's like, okay, guys, we're going to do the maneuver.
The maneuver.
And Buck, I want you to do it. So Bobby goes up to talk to the girlfriend. It's funny. He's like, well, did you really cheat on her? And did you really cheat on him? The implication is yes.
Yeah.
Bobby starts talking the guy down by telling this elaborate story of how he was once cheated on by his fiance and they were in Paris and he got down on one knee and he's drawing out this story really long. And then Buck like kicks the guy, comes down from the roof, kicks the guy back into the apartment. Yeah. And it turns out Bobby was just making up this story to stall and buy them some time.
The woman fucking like turns to him and goes, and what did she say? He's like, what? The girl in Paris? He's like, oh, I don't know. We never get that far in the story.
Yeah. Pretty good. That's a pretty good scene. Funny.
Peter Krause, I love him. Isn't he just like the most charismatic guy ever?
He is. And I mean, I love the sort of like ridiculousness of the way they get this guy out of the situation is just by fucking kicking him so hard.
Right in the fucking like rib cage.
Yeah, like I hope he's not injured by this.
Yeah, oh my god.
But basically this kind of redeems Buck a little bit in his feeling, you know, makes him,
yeah.
He saved a life, finally.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like bringing his sort of like episode arc full circle and saying, even though, you know, you lost this guy or maybe these guys, we don't know about the second guy. It's fine.
Yeah. Mystery.
In a way, it does sort of, I guess, validate Chimney's theory of every call being a one night stand. You know what I mean?
Right. Like, it's just another one. You let it go. Theme of the episode, let go.
There was that one thing that Athena said in that scene in the beginning of the episode when they're having their family dinner, where she goes, the reason why we wear uniforms is so that at the end of the day, we could take them off, right?
Yeah, I like that line.
Yeah, and so it's like a big learning moment for Buck.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to harp on it too much because, listen, we go on tangents on this podcast. It happens.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm so obsessed with this fucking couple.
No, go ahead.
I'm so obsessed with them. I mean, like, first of all, he's right on the money. She totally cheated on him. But I love him. Like, he's such a goddamn drama queen. Like that bit where he's, like, dangling his foot over the side, like, taunting her.
I wanted to bring up a specific line he has where he's saying that she's cheating on him with, quote, that werewolf-looking guy from work. I just wrote in my notes, was it Scott McCall?
Oh my god, okay, because we know Scott was working in LA.
He would work in LA. Oh my god, maybe the woman works at like a veterinary office with Scott McCall.
This was pre-Allison's revival in the Teen Wolf timeline.
Exactly.
So.
He could have dabbled a little bit before that.
Yeah, why not, you know?
Things to know about us as podcast hosts is that we're always going to be bringing up Glee and we're always going to be bringing up Teen Wolf, probably.
Yeah, literally, yeah. Because it's like, in fairness, when you look at everything that happens in the world, they'll either relate to Glee or Teen Wolf in some way.
Exactly. It's like those two shows kind of encompass like all of the human experience. So put together, you have just about everything.
What was that thing Judi Dench said about the complete works of William Shakespeare? She said, every emotion in the human experience can be found in this book.
You know? It's just like that.
It's just like that. I think the same can be said about the combination of Glee and Teen Wolf. So.
Absolutely.
I'm obsessed with this lady fucking telling him to jump.
Oh my god. So yeah, frustrated. When she just gives up and starts telling him to jump. So after that, we get back to
the firehouse.
Back to the fire station, and who should come and visit Buck but the sister of Devin again. And she's kind of there to apologize, and they actually have a really nice moment where they sort of establish that actually Devin had been suicidal at one point, and not that it's his fault for what happened, but they kind of established that, yeah, maybe he actually was not in a good place in general, and it's not really Buck's fault that he just sort of gave in that moment and decided to drop.
She herself feels a sense of guilt and shame for Devin being there because she had convinced his friend to take him out. So she feels directly responsible in a way, not just for Devin's death, but also presumably for his friend's death as well. And so in that moment, she was transferring her own feelings of guilt and of shame and of grief onto Buck as a sort of, I guess, an avatar of a thing that she could pin it on so that she didn't have to deal with it all at once.
I think it's a really nice moment.
And I guess the thing to take away from it is that, like, I don't want to be doomerish about it and say, like, there was nothing to be done or anything, because, like, there's a thousand ways that could have gone.
Yeah.
But it's no one's fault. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
It's no one's fault. And there's no one really to blame.
I do have to say what Buck says to her. He says something echoing something Abby said to him earlier, which is, some people just don't want to be saved. And I can't help but feel like that would also come off as insensitive in the same way that he just gave up earlier came off as insensitive.
Yeah.
Like, I understand why they don't have her lash out at him again, but I feel like he could have found a softer way to say, that sentiment.
Yeah. But I mean, that is the reality of the situation. Mm-hmm. That is true, though. I mean, like, yeah. I feel like if anything, from Buck's character's perspective, you know, you could argue that, like, that line was just as much about him sort of learning to let go and not get so caught up in the why of things happening. You know what I mean? Or the mm-hmm. how could I do this differently, I guess, which is...
Yeah.
But I hear that, you know, I mean, listen, love our baby girl, but he be putting his foot square in his mouth a lot.
Yeah, he's still learning. Yeah, we go back to the Abby, Carla, Abby's mom part of the plot. They're like going out mm-hmm. for ice cream, cute little girl's day. And once again, I think this is when we get the girl, you are a hot spice pumpkin latte line. I wrote it down in my notes.
I think it was, yeah.
That was just the only one where I was like, you're going a little too far, Ryan, Tim, and Brad.
Yeah. Reel it in, white men. Come on.
She once again encourages Abby to call Buck, which she once again does. And I thought Buck was like already surprisingly emotionally intelligent in this conversation because like the self-awareness, it's almost a little unrealistic, I think, the self-awareness he's showing when he says, he has this crazy line where he's like, I'm starting to realize that I might have like problems with women and intimacy or something. I was like, oh man, maybe that therapy session really did work in some way. But yeah, I was like, would he really have this level of like articulation of his exact problems at this point?
Dude, not you said that one firefighter that's too woke.
More like that one firefighter that's too emotionally intelligent.
Right. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's true.
I'm happy for him, though. And I'm glad it is nice to watch an emotionally mature conversation in some ways. It's a nice conversation. Basically, what happens is Abby kind of asks him out and he says, actually, I'm learning that I have problems with women and intimacy. So why don't we just be friends who talk to each other?
Yeah. And they settle on the phone relationship, which is cute. It's cute. It's sweet.
Yeah, although he does have that line early in the conversation where he's like, how old are you? Because you keep calling me, so you must be old.
Dude, oh my god, the absolute fumble is insane.
Honestly, like, fuck, you have a beautiful woman on the phone. Don't neg her right now.
His copy of the game is being worn out. Okay, this is what I had to Google, because he's not wrong. He like, you know, like normally we'd text or we'd snap or if it's serious, mm-hmm. we'd FaceTime. But in the middle of that list, he said something that I'd never even heard of in my life, which was Marco Polo.
Yeah, I also, that stuck out to me too.
Like, what the fuck is Marco Polo? So I was Googling it, and it was basically just like a service where you could send little short messages to each other, kind of like little vines or little
I think I have heard of it. Snaps. I think it's one of those things like, I don't know, like Periscope or whatever that was like big for like 1 year. And maybe that year was 2018 when they were making the first season and then never again. And now it's like lost to time.
Yeah. I mean, if it was big, it must have been big with a different demographic than me. Because
well, maybe it's like a sex thing about it. like maybe it would have been big to Buck because it was like, I mean, you know, like Snapchat was kind of for that stuff sometimes. Like maybe in Buck's world, it was good for his hookups or something. I have no idea. Clearly, neither of us are educated on Marco Polo.
Right.
Yeah, that's a funny, like, instantly dated line.
Yeah. I mean, even Snapchat is like I think it's pretty dated. Well, maybe just because I'm not on Snapchat anymore. You know what I mean?
No, I'm not either.
I haven't been on it since I was, like, 19 or 20.
I haven't been on it since I was, like, 16, probably.
Yeah. I'm good. I have Twitter. I have Instagram. It's fine.
It's not 2016 anymore, guys.
We don't need an app for everything. I didn't even get into Be Real.
Oh, no. Me neither.
Is that still going on? Is Be Real still going on?
I think. I don't know. I'm not in touch enough with the youth.
You are the youth.
No, not anymore. They end this conversation with Abby saying when she gets back to the group, she's like, I got turned down. They're like, well, why are you smiling then? And she says, sometimes the right kind of no is better than the wrong kind of yes.
And she ate that.
She did. I liked that a lot. So emotionally mature. So great.
Yeah, really great. And my question that was lingering was, what fucking kind of ice cream was she eating?
It looked kind of green, right? I was thinking mint chocolate chip, right?
I'll get into like mint chocolate chip, but like I don't know, I feel like that's like a greener green. It looked like green
tea. It could
have
been pistachio.
Or like pistachio ice cream, yeah.
We've just established that we both worked at ice cream places, so actually we have some insider ice cream knowledge.
Yeah, but like mine was more like the peanut butter parfait core ice cream.
Oh, sure.
Or like the dip cones.
I worked at like a gourmet ice cream shop. It was sort of a mom and pop place, but they also like their thing was that they had a lot of specialty flavors and like a lot of specialty ingredients. So
I'm pretty
sure we had a green tea flavor. We actually had a basil flavor.
Really?
She was eating. Yeah, maybe she was eating basil ice cream.
I don't even know what that. I guess it would taste like basil, but like I can't even imagine that.
It was okay. It was kind of like, you know, if you have a very like specific type of palate or. It was refreshing. We also had a lemon basil sorbet. That was a lot better, I thought. That's like a palate
cleanser.
Sounds
really good, actually. That sounds really, like, just a little bit of it at the end of the meal to sort of like, yeah, That sounds
very
really
refreshing.
Nice, actually.
So finally, we cut to one last little snippet of Athena's home life. She comes home. Harry is home, like, doing his homework or something, but she can't find May. Harry says she's in her room. So she goes into May's room, and May... she finds these pill bottles on the floor, and May is like unconscious, appears to have taken the pills and overdosed and is unresponsive. So the episode actually ends with Athena calling 911, and she says, like, I think my daughter's dead. It's very dramatic, big cliffhanger.
Yeah. It's honestly, it's a really effective cliffhanger because it does just make you want to watch the next one, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to say, I put in my notes, like, powerhouse Angela Bassett performance.
Oh my god, dude, seriously.
Very effective.
Yeah. I mean, like, she really owned this episode. Do you remember in the fucking, the first breakfast scene when they're, like, getting ready for school? And it's, like, kind of like a vision of domestic bliss, and then Michael offers her coffee, and she's like, she gets that, like, that scowl, and she goes, no.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, serious, like, powerhouse performance, and, like, it really comes to a head here when she fucking sees May on the floor, and just, like, just, like, the huge shift in her everything. Like, you really see, like, the fear in her and the
terror.
And
she's just such a professional, like, I, for some reason, I was picturing what, however many takes they had done, and I could just picture, like, that she could just turn that on for every single take, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
She's just so good.
So good. Yeah. And then the episode ends.
Ready for more.
It was a pretty stacked episode.
I would say, yeah, it's a good one.
It's pretty remarkable how much they managed to stuff into like 40 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
You know?
I think that's part of the appeal in general of 911 is, yeah, there is usually a lot going on. Very fast paced.
Remember when they made the most of their 10 episode seasons?
Oh, God. Well, I don't think you could say season 7 didn't try to make the most of it, but maybe that was part of the problem, actually.
That's fair, actually, now that I mention it.
I think they were shooting for the stars, not quite hitting them.
But here on season 1, I think they were hitting every beat, and honestly really enjoying just reliving like what made me fall in love with this show in the first place way back in the day.
I'm very excited by, I've been getting some comments on my video, like multiple comments from people saying like, okay, you've convinced me, I'm going to watch this show now. And that is just special to me. I think it's really fun, and I'm excited for all these people to go on their journeys.
Because it will be a journey, and they're going to fall right down that rabbit hole.
Yeah.
You know? And we're going to be here with the watch-along.
Exactly, with the First Verse podcast. I actually got a comment like this morning that was somebody who had previously commented, like, I'm going to start watching it. And then they commented, like, I hate you for introducing me to this show because I'm so obsessed with it already. And I've, like, cried all these times watching it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that about wraps up our episode. Tune in next week, whenever we post this, for episode 3.
Episode 3. And don't forget to follow us on social media. On Twitter, I am at Dan, Dirty. And on Instagram, I am at Prime Minister of Sadness.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Jane _Mulcahy. And I'm not sure I'm even going to keep plugging my Instagram because I never post on there. So I don't think it's worth it. And also, I don't like saying out loud that I have the X in my username, like the Troye Sivan. Don't want to have to make that comparison every time.
Oh my God, your blue neighborhood is crazy. Like...
Maybe I'm thinking I should make like some social media channels for the podcast. So
yeah,
I haven't done that yet. But when I do, I'll make sure to plug it.
Thank you so much for listening, guys. And see you next week.
See you next week.
Hopefully with fewer self-diagnosed UTIs.
Yeah, hopefully. Oh my gosh. Everybody pray for me.
Sending up a prayer request for Jane.
Thank you for that.